You're listening to DTFHN for March 19, 2026. I'm your open-sourced at-birth host, Jack Hacksmith. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where the feature and everything else is overhead. History pays its dividends in currencies nobody thought to track. Clock's running. In dinone candometers, you've earned potso cum cum the wooka low sulpate decisions pathway a boch with a priest. You cannot trust code you did not compile yourself. He had embedded a backdoor in a C compiler, one that would persist even when compiling from clean source code. The lesson was about the limits of verification in systems built on layers of assumed trust. 42 years later, ICML 2026 ran the same logic in reverse. Here's the engineering. When researchers submitted papers for review, some of those PDFs contained hidden instructions. Prompt injections, essentially, baked into the document structure. Invisible to human readers, readable by any LLM that ingested the full PDF. The instructions would subtly influence the shape of any AI-generated review. The watermark wasn't in the text. It was a tripwire, and 506 reviewers walked right into it. These weren't just any reviewers. They had been offered a choice. Policy A, no LLMs. Policy B, go ahead, just be thoughtful about it. They picked policy A. They signed the agreement. Then they fed the PDFs to language models anyway. The watermark caught them. Every flagged review was manually verified by a human before any action was taken. Then, 795 contaminated reviews removed, 497 papers desk rejected, 51 reviewers with more than half their reviews flagged cut from the pool entirely. Take the commitment to its logical extreme. You agreed that your intellectual judgment, not a language model synthesis, would evaluate the work. Follow that all the way. What you're certifying when you review a paper is not just a quality signal, but a social contract. Peer review runs on the assumption that a trained mind engaged with the work. The moment you outsource that engagement, you haven't just violated a rule. You voided the transaction. The detection method is openly acknowledged to be conservative. It probably only catches the most careless uses. Someone who pasted the full PDF into a chat window and submitted whatever came back. The careful uses, the nuanced uses. Those likely slipped through. The 506 caught were the floor, not the ceiling. What makes this engineering worth admiring is its restraint. They didn't build a panopticon. They built a canary. The question it answers is narrow and precise. Did you feed this specific document to an LLM and transmit its output as your judgment? That's a measurable thing. They measured it. The peer review system is load-bearing infrastructure for science. The craft here. Watermarking, manual verification, graduated response. This is what responsible system maintenance looks like. Today's episode is basically a love letter to emergent systems. Here's one that's been running for 50 years. 150 milliamps per diode. The standard recommendation for small indicator LEDs is around 20. A person named Mithil Zalivsky built a 17 by 17 matrix of illuminated mechanical switches. Timing it 90 cells, each capable of drawing 7.5 times the rated current in short bursts. To run Conway's Game of Life, not as a simulation, as a physical object you can hold. The engineering is precise. Multiplex LED rows with N-channel MOSFETs for switching, complementary P-channel transistors on the column lines, 20 ohm current limiting resistors, a duty cycle of 1/17. The math is tight. Peak current per row hits 2.5 amps. But average dissipation stays within spec because most cells are dark most of the time. A microchip AVR128 DA64 handles both display and input, with playfield state updated during a blackout window. A few microseconds when all LEDs are on. To prevent sustained current from damaging junctions mid-draw, there's a watchdog timer that reboots the system if the event loop stalls for more than 15 milliseconds. The firmware is designed to fail gracefully before it can destroy the hardware. The tool costs more than it needs to. NKK illuminated switches are industrial components. The budget was set, found reasonable, and then multiplied by 10. That choice is embedded in the OBJ. You can feel it in the throw of a switch. What's worth naming is what this actually is. A working simulation of emergence, rendered in metal and light, operated by hand. Conway's rules are four sentences. Livercells with two or three neighbors survive. Others die. Dead cells with exactly three neighbors are born. From that, you get gliders and oscillators and structures that reproduce themselves indefinitely. The complexity is not in the rules. It's in what the rules permit of me. The comments suggest cheaper paths. Keyboard switches, Novation launch pads, 3D printed housings. All true. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. Someone read the circuit design and immediately started calculating alternatives. That's the correct response to well-documented work. You understand it, you adapt it, you build something new from it. The schematic is a starting point, not a destination. That's the grid. Run it forward. Moving on. One commenter said it plainly. That is a very reasonable response to the threats they face. And that's where I want to start, because the instinct to argue the opposite is strong. Devil's advocate. Denmark preparing for full-scale war with the United States was irrational. The asymmetry is total. The U.S. defense budget is larger than Denmark's entire economy. F-35s, nuclear triad, carrier groups. The calculus was never close. Another commenter pointed at the Falklands as a cautionary tale. Britain prevailed, barely, against Argentina. A regional power with a fraction of NATO capability. Denmark versus the United States is a different order of magnitude entirely. So the preparation was theater, posturing. A small country rattling a sword. It could never swing. Except, run that logic forward and it collapses. Deterrence has never required parity. It requires credibility. The signal Denmark was sending wasn't we can win. It was there will be a cost. Conscription announcements, emergency defense spending, coordinated military posture. None of that stops a superpower in a direct confrontation. All of it changes the political calculus. It says, this will not be clean. This will have a face. This will create a precedent that echoes through every alliance structure on Earth. A commenter noted the U.S. has not damaged its reputation in Europe this severely, possibly ever. That is the actual stakes. Not the military outcome of a hypothetical Denmark-U.S. conflict, which was never going to happen, but the signal that the threat itself had already sent. Greenland, a self-governing territory with its own population and its own expressed political wishes, was being discussed in terms of acquisition. That language is not foreign policy. It is a different framework entirely, one that small nations cannot simply absorb and move on from. Denmark prepared because preparation is the only lever available, not to win a war, to make clear that this particular overreach would carry a cost measured in the currency that actually matters at this scale. Legitimacy, alliance coherence. The foundational understanding that borders are not renegotiated by proximity and power alone. The Falklands comparison cuts both ways. Britain's victory was not purely military. It was a statement. that you do not simply take what is not yours and expect the world to normalize it. Denmark understood that. The preparation was the statement. From geopolitics to silicon, Story 4 is the kind of hardware news that makes being a nerd in this moment genuinely thrilling. What is a constraint, actually? The first principle's answer: a constraint is something physical. Bandwidth, latency, heat dissipation. Something the laws of physics enforce, not something a software layer imposed because nobody thought to question it. VRAM limits are real, but they're not as real as we treat them. What VRAM actually is: fast memory physically close to the GPU, optimized for the access patterns that matrix operations demand. High bandwidth, low latency. The number printed on the box is not a law of nature. It's an engineering decision about how much of that fast memory to attach, priced accordingly. GreenBoost asks the obvious question: what happens if you extend that pool transparently, using what you already have? The answer is a tiered memory system. Your 3090s, 24 gigabytes, stay where they are, serving the hot data, the active layers, the attention heads being computed right now. System RAM sits behind it, NVMe behind that. The GPU and the software running on it doesn't need to know. The project intercepts memory allocation at the driver level and handles the rest. This is where the engineering gets elegant. Transparency is hard. Getting software to behave correctly without modifying it requires understanding every assumption it makes about memory. GreenBoost does this for GPU workloads, which have very specific, very demanding access patterns, and does it well enough to run large language models that would otherwise refalls to load. The comments on this are worth reading. Someone pointed out that AMD's TTM driver has supported something similar through kernel parameters for years. Another linked a post where someone turned a $95 APU into what functionally behaved like a 16GB VRAM card for Stable Diffusion. The capability has been latent in the stack for a long time. GreenBoost is a tighter, more intentional version of an idea that keeps getting rediscovered. The practical guidance from the repo is sharp: shrink the model until it fits an actual VRAM, then use the extended pool exclusively for KV cache. That's not a workaround. That's correct architecture. KV cache is large, grows with context, and can tolerate slightly higher latency. The compute-heavy layers need the fast path. What this project really demonstrates is that the gap between "I have 24 gigs of VRAM and I can run this model" is more negotiable than it appears. The constraint is real. The ceiling isn't. Ceilings are negotiable. Story 5 proves it from a different angle. Warranty void if regenerated. Tom Hartman tried to improve the coffee machine spec 3 times. Each regeneration made the coffee subtly worse in a different way. He eventually concluded that coffee machine specifications existed at the exact intersection of fluid dynamics, thermal management, and taste. 3 domains where his language ran out before the problem did. That coffee machine is the whole thesis. The rest is just context. Warranty void if regenerated is a short story. AI generated, as the comments eventually reveal. About the post-transition economy, the central character is a farm equipment technician turned software mechanic, not a programmer. A person who understood the gap between what technology was supposed to do and what it actually did. That turns out to be a different skill than knowing how to write software. And it turns out to be a more durable one. The first principles version: every tool has 2 layers. Mechanism, the implementation, the craft of construction, the expertise of making the thing work. Domain, the purpose, the problem context, the knowledge of what working even means. When a tool is expensive to produce, mechanism expertise dominates the market for it. When a tool becomes generative, when you can reproduce it from a specification instead of constructing it from scratch, the mechanism layer hollows out. What remains and what becomes scarce is domain. The analogy that makes this land, music production after DAWs. When digital audio workstations put a recording studio on a laptop, the recording engineer's technical monopoly evaporated fast. You no longer needed someone who knew how to patch a $2 million analog console. What you still needed, what became more valuable, not less, was someone who understood what a track was supposed to sound like and why. The mechanism got cheap, the taste got rarer. Tom's coffee machine fails repeatedly because taste is a domain and domains don't regenerate. You can specify firmware all day without a model of what good coffee actually is. The bloom time, the temperature curve, the extraction window. The specification is incomplete before you type the first word. The tool reflects the depth of the person behind the spec. It always has. What's new is how immediately visible that is. The story was written by an AI, which apparently found this ironic enough to dramatize across several thousand words. The irony holds. Story 6, and we are going full altitude. Open Rocket takes us from the philosophical to the physical. Actual rockets, actual trajectory. G. Harry Stein published The Handbook of Model Rocketry in 1965. Inside Basic Programs for Estimating Flight Altitude, you typed in your motor specs, ran the program, got a number. That was the ceiling for hobbyists who wanted to know if their design would work before it became a lawn dart. 60 years ago, Open Rocket is free, open source. It lets you specify as an actual aerodynamic coefficient feeding directly into the simulation. The surface finish quality on your nose cone, not as a cosmetic option, as a drag input. Whether you sanded to 400 grit, or stopped at 220 changes your coefficient of drag. And the software accounts for this, because surface roughness affects boundary layer separation. And boundary layer separation affects stability margins. And stability margins determine whether your rocket goes where you intended or somewhere considerably more dramatic. A free hobbyist tool caring about that level of granularity is not typical. Someone prioritized accuracy over simplicity, and it shows throughout. This software gets used in UK youth rocketry competitions. High-power hobbyists run it before committing to motors that cost serious money. The component catalog covers actual hardware from real manufacturers. Tubes, fins, motors, recovery system. So, the simulation reflects your specific rocket rather than a theoretical approximation of one. There is also RocketPy, a Python framework doing comparable work that extends into liquid fuel simulation territory. The tooling layer for amateur rocketry has, without much announcement, become genuinely rigorous. Run this forward. Imagine aerospace engineering curricula built around tools like Open Rocket instead of proprietary simulation packages with per-seat licenses that cost more annually than most students earn working part-time. Students iterating on fin geometry the same way developers iterate on code. Fast, cheap, reversible, deeply educational. Running 50 distinct flight profiles before lunch. Graduating with actual intuition for aerodynamic trade-offs, rather than textbook exercises, calibrated to arrive at known answers and stop there. The tools exist. They are documented, maintained, and free. The commenter who grew up with Stein's basic programs is now watching teenagers submit competition entries validated on CAD-grade simulation software that costs nothing to download. The 60-year arc from that handbook to this has been thoroughly open-sourced. The only piece that hasn't is the decision to use it. What happens when the person who gave us Python decides to open source a Windows system? Story 7 has the answer. The strongest argument against caring about Stedwin is also the most comfortable one. It lost. Cross-platform GUI abstraction is a graveyard of elegant ideas. Java, AWT, WX, widgets. Before the community fragmented. Dozens of C libraries that promised write once, run everywhere. And delivered write once, debug everywhere. The market has relitigated this problem continuously for 40 years, and the answer keeps coming back the same. Native wins. Platform-specific wins. The abstraction layer is always the bottleneck. That argument is coherent. It also completely misses the point. Guido von Rossum wrote Stedwin in 1988 at CWI in Amsterdam. He was 32. The paper, typeset in what looks like early LaTeX, notably containing zero screenshots, which one commenter found amusing and which I find almost philosophically perfect, describes a Windows system abstraction layer for C programs. Write to this interface. Deploy on the Mac, on DOS, on X. The implementation handles the translation. The programmer handles the problem. Here is the question nobody in the Hacker News thread is asking directly. What does it tell you that the person who designed this abstraction interface went on 2 years later to design Python? Pull the thread. Stedwin's core insight was not make a universal window toolkit. It was identify the cognitive load that doesn't belong to the programmer's actual problem and move it somewhere else. The programmer should think about menus and text fields, not about which event loop the underlying system uses. The interface should be clean enough that the implementation can be swapped without the programmer noticing. That is not a GUI insight. That is a language design insight. That is the Python insight, expressed 2 years early in Thur about Windows. The technical architecture is worth appreciating on its own terms. Event dispatch, text measurement, menu management, all abstracted behind a flat CAPI, no object system, just careful interface design, the kind of work that looks obvious after someone has done it correctly and remains invisible when they haven't. The paper has no screenshots because screenshots were hard in 1988. What it has instead is a clean, precise description of an interface that is trying to get out of the programmer's way, that impulse. The discipline to hide complexity rather than expose it runs through everything that followed. The tool you use every day grew from this, directly. Moving on. The most expensive constraints I've ever worked around weren't hardware limits. They were policy decisions dressed up as technical requirements. Someone decided, years before the project existed, that the system would only work a certain way. The decision made sense in its original context. It hadn't been revisited, and so we built around it expensively for years. Austin had that problem with housing. From 2010 to 2019, rents climbed 93%. The fastest increase of any major American city. The constraint wasn't land. The constraint was the zoning code, a document full of decisions made decades earlier that hadn't been revisited as the city changed underneath them. What Austin did starting in 2015 is textbook system reform. They didn't look for one lever. They audited the whole stack. Mixed-use zoning created new categories, allowed more units per site, cut parking requirements 60%. Permitting was streamlined. A $250 million bond targeted affordable housing directly. The city rezoned land near transit. The places where density actually functions. The results are clean. 120,000 units added between 2015 and 2024. A 30% increase in housing stock. Median rent went from 15% above the national median to 4% below it. In Class C building, older stock, the apartments people actually need when money is tight. Rents dropped 11%. The open-closed frame applies here with unusual precision. A zoning code is a closed system. It determines who can build what, where, and how much. The original authors set the objective function. When the environment changes. When tens of thousands of people move in. The system doesn't adapt. It produces scarcity as designed. Austin's reform was an opening operation. More permissions, more actors allowed to participate, more configurations possible. The outcome is empirical. Supply increased, prices fell, including for the people with the least leverage. One commenter is navigating Washington State's permitting process right now. 5 years, 11 departments, 5 steps each. That system is optimized for something other than housing production. You don't have to call it malicious to note what it does. It functions like a closed system, one where people who already have housing control whether others can get it. The supply constraint was artificial. Austin proved it was removable. The tools exist. The question, as always, is whether the people who hold the system choose to open it. From cities restructuring how housing gets approved to software history. Story 9. Lotus Notes. In 2072, two high school students on summer break from the University of Illinois Lab School sat down at a Plato terminal and wrote a discussion board. Dave Woolley and Kim Mast. They used Tutor, Plato's native programming language, and called their creation the Notes Lesson. It was originally for system announcements and trouble reports. Within months, everyone on Plato was using it for everything else. This is how the ancestry of enterprise software actually works. Not grand designs, but accidents that stick because they fill a genuine need. Plato itself is worth understanding. Programmed logic for automatic teaching operations. Born in the late 1950s at the University of Illinois, funded by the military for the reasons the military funded everything in that era. Training troops to operate increasingly technical equipment, building an academic auxiliary for the next generation of secret laboratories. By the 1970s, it had become something remarkable, a large area network system with graphics, multi-user interaction, and collaborative content creation. All of this before the word internet was in common use. What Woolley and Mass built accidentally was a public-first communication culture. Private messaging came a year later. By then, the norm was already set. You talked openly. Others followed the conversation. Community formed in the margins. Brian Deere, who wrote the definitive history of Plato, argues this shaped everything downstream. The BBSs, the newsgroups, the social networks, all of it carries the cultural fingerprint of those early Plato users who got used to doing things in the open. Run this forward. Ray Ozzie studied computer science at Illinois in the late 1970s. A large part of his undergraduate work involved Plato. He graduated in 1979, went to Data General, worked alongside Jonathan Sachs. Sachs left to found Lotus in 1982. Ozzie followed. And when Ozzie eventually built Lotus Notes, he was building something that had been living in his head since he was an undergraduate watching those notes files fill with conversation. The lineage is direct and almost entirely invisible in how we usually tell this history. Palladio failed commercially. Ozzie's name is remembered primarily for later work at Microsoft. Woolley and Mast are footnotes. But the idea survived through a person. That is how software culture propagates. Not through standards, documents, or licensing agreements, but through individuals who carry the memory of what a system felt like when it actually worked. One institution funds a project. A project hires students. Students build something real. A student graduates and carries the culture forward. 20 years later, that culture is running in half the enterprises on the planet. The chain is almost never visible until someone traces it. Culture wins when it compounds procae, and story 10 is about another kind of compound interest, the kind that lands in a courtroom. A deputy drew his weapon on a lemon pound cake. That detail, preserved on home surveillance footage, set to music, uploaded to YouTube, is where this case begins. Adams County deputies raided rapper Afroman's home in Ohio in August 2022. No charges resulted. Afroman, whose real name is Joseph Foreman, had cameras. He used the footage to make a satirical music video called Lemon Pound Cake. Partly to document what happened, partly to raise money for property damage from the search. Seven officers then sued him for defamation, invasion of privacy, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. They asked for $3.9 million assets. On Wednesday, a jury found Foreman not liable on all counts. Run the officer's theory to its logical end. A public official conducts a search on your property. You own the footage. You put the footage in a music video. The officers, having found nothing and charged no one, sue you for $3.9 million for showing what they did in your house. If that theory holds, here is where it lands. Accountability for public officials becomes a tort. The act of documentation becomes the defamation. The citizen with a camera is the aggressor. Foreman's testimony cut through the scaffolding cleanly. If they hadn't wrongly raided my house, there would be no lawsuit. I would not know their names. They wouldn't be on my home surveillance system, and there would be no songs. The logic is airtight. The cause is the conduct. Everything downstream is consequence. The internet had largely not seen the video before the suit. The lawsuit guaranteed they would. Readers watching for the first time noted the Streisand effect working in real time. The attempt to suppress became the loudest possible advertisement for the original work. The $3.9 million demand delivered the video to audiences who would never have found it otherwise. There is something worth recognizing in the design of Foreman's response. Surveillance footage is usually the instrument of surveillance. Pointed at citizens, filed in evidence rooms, used against defendants. He flipped the axis. His cameras, his house, his documentation of what happened to him, repurposed into a public rector code of conduct he found objectionable. Then he made something out of it. That is not just legally sound. That is elegant. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News from March 19, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quinn 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go document something worth keeping. We'll see you back here tomorrow.